You're listening to the Newsmakers podcast from MLB.com.
This is the Rocket, Bill Adson. Welcome to Newsmakers. We have a lot going on today. I had a great conversation with Yankees manager Aaron Boone. It's Black History Month, and I spoke to Astros broadcaster Robert Ford and former Orioles outfielder Al Bunbury. I then talked to Richard Justice, who names 10 players who can determine playoff races. We start with Aaron Boone, who is ready to win a championship with the Yankees. On the phone is the new Yankee manager, Aaron Boone, one of the good guys in baseball. Aaron, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Bill. It's good to be on with you.
Thank you so much. Aaron, has it hit you yet that you are the manager of the Yankees? Spring training starts in a couple weeks. What do you think?
Yeah, I think to some degree it's hit me because we've been so busy and kind of trying to, you know, get our team put together, putting a staff together, you know, all that goes into the off season and trying to prepare and get ready for spring training and you know, the reaching out and trying to connect and build relationships with players. So, you know, it's been a lot going on, a lot of media stuff, obviously, as well. So I guess to some degree, it definitely feels like I am. I did have a conversation with AJ Hinch, and he said, you know, the first time it'll truly hit you is when you stand in front of your team in spring training. And so maybe there's another level of realizing that I am the manager. But so far, I've really enjoyed it and really enjoyed all the work that's gone into getting prepared for the season.
What do you like about the 2018 Yankees other than the fact you have two power bats, Giancarlo Stanton and Aaron Judge?
Well, I like that when you look at our roster and, you know, certainly our position players, for the most part, it's guys, you know, in the prime of their career or even haven't even reached the prime of their career, not to mention, you know, a farm system that is very, very strong, in great shape, and we feel like there'll be at least a couple guys that have a chance to contribute in a meaningful way to this year's major league team from our farm system. So you just feel like the organization is in on such solid ground. And I think for as great a season as they had last year, and we saw many guys kind of come of age, I think, you know, one thing people always notice now in covering this team is, yeah, they're excellent players on the field. It's guys that look like it seemed to be having a lot of fun playing the game. But it's also a lot of really good guys in the clubhouse, a lot of high-character individuals. And that's why I think one of the real appealing things of this job is knowing that, you know, I'm taking over a room with a lot of quality people in it.
What's the one thing, I know you haven't managed yet, what's the one thing you like to see the team improve on based on a stat you saw?
I don't know if there's one thing necessarily, Bill. I mean, we're trying to, you know, the way I look at it is we're trying to squeeze everything out of every player, you know, and so it's whether it's, you know, giving someone better information, helping them take another step, whether it be on the defensive side of the ball or gaining an edge in the running game or in base running, those kind of little things that you really grill down on in spring training. You know, we want to get the most out of each individual player, and that's upon us as coaches, the information that's available, and the better we can get that into the hands of these players and see them continue to improve and not just stand still, if you will, in their development, mm-hmm. I feel like that's our biggest challenge.
Aaron, after a number of years in the booth, I thought you were natural, and I personally was surprised you went back on the field. And my question is, why did you do that? Why did you want to become a manager?
Yeah. Well, I loved working for ESPN. I loved the job. It was, for me, retiring at the end of the 2009 season, it just was a kind of a seamless transition for me. It was a perfect transition. I loved the job. I loved the art of it. I loved that I got to stay connected to the game. I love that I had a small voice within the game, but I would say in the last year and a half or so, you know, I've told people a lot that I feel like the game was calling me a little bit, and I've really started to get that itch to, you know, get back with an organization, get back with a team, and kind of that, I guess, the competitive juice is just kind of flowing a little bit. And so I was considering making a move this offseason. I was in some conversations with a couple of different clubs about joining a front office, possibly becoming a coach with a team. So I was starting to transition, I think, out of the booth probably, mm-hmm. whether I got the Yankee job or not. Then in the midst of those talks with other teams and possibly joining other franchises, the interview with the Yankees happened, and then, you know, obviously the rest is history from there.
Your father told me that when you were a little kid, you would go behind home plate and pretend that you were managing the game. Did you know way back when that you wanted to manage?
No. I will say this. You know, I was the little kid, you know, at 3 years old. My mom will tell you this. Obviously, my dad will tell you this. But I was the kid sitting in the stands when the other kids were in the kids' room playing or playing their toys. I was the one sitting there watching the game, like never taking my eyes off it, whether I was, you know, thinking about imitating a player or just watching all that was going on. I felt like from a very young age, it just captivated me. But no, I never necessarily thought at any point, ooh, I want to manage someday. There were maybe times later in my career or even during my broadcasting career where, you know, it's been, you know, something that I considered or something that I thought maybe I'd like to do at some point. But it wasn't this burning desire or like my, I guess, lifetime goal to one day manage. It's just kind of the path that's unfolded for me here in the last couple of years.
Can you tell me your father's reaction when he heard that you were the manager of the Yankees? I'm sure it was a great day.
Yeah. So when Brian Cashman called me and informed me that it was going to be me and that they were, you know, he's going to recommend me to ownership and that they wanted to focus their full attention on me. And so basically there was, you know, a 24-hour period of just negotiating and I think Brian letting the other candidates know that they're going in a different direction. So when he told me, I couldn't say anything for the first 24 hours, but I was able to call my dad and he was kind of calling me every day, just like, hey, did you hear anything? He was very interested, obviously. Yeah. And I'd just be like, no. And then finally I called him that day and I said, almost right after I got off the phone with Brian Cashman, and I said, and I actually kind of slow played it a little bit. I'm like, hey, Dad, what are you doing? And I said, he goes, I'm like, Cash called, kind of in a downer voice, and he said, oh, he did? I'm like, yeah, and I'm like, I got it. And he started laughing right away in that kind of giggle voice he has, and then almost immediately turned into crying. And I haven't seen my dad cry very often in my lifetime, but that was one of them where I could hear him on the other end of the phone breaking down a little bit. He was very excited.
Yes, yes, I can imagine. Now, you know, your father managed in the past. What do you learn when you watched him manage? What do you take to the Yankees that you learned from him?
Well, I think, I don't know if osmosis is the right term, but look, he's been the biggest influence in my life, certainly in my baseball life. So, you know, I don't know if there's anything specific. But, you know, I'm certainly a product of my mom and dad, you know, and you know, all that, whatever I have in me, I'm sure there's a lot of traits or qualities or shortcomings, however you want to look at it, that we both have. I mean, that's just, I think when father, son, and you're close and they've had a huge influence on you, I'm going to take things with me. As far as, you know, anything specific, frankly, we haven't had any, you know, we talk about baseball kind of things all the time and what's going on in the game. Mm-hmm. And that really hasn't changed. It hasn't, you know, it hasn't been like him you know, giving me advice, necessarily specific advice about managing or anything. It's more just our conversations that we've had throughout our lifetime about the game. Now, one thing, once the season begins and I'm in the fire and things are going on, I think those will be times where, you know, you have those occasions where late nights, you know, you might reach out to him and lean on him, because one thing I've had throughout my career and been fortunate as a player is having a grandfather, having a dad, having a brother mm-hmm. that, you know, you could bounce things off that could certainly relate to, you know, what was going on with you and your job. And my dad will certainly be a sounding board for me, I'm sure, as this job unfolds over the next few years.
Now, you mentioned this earlier. You know, not only do you have great veterans on this team, you have some great prospects. I mean, you're loaded. You're stacked with prospects. Well, of the prospects, who are you looking forward to seeing in spring training? You got a lot of them.
Yeah. Well, you know, Gleyber Torres is a guy I'm so excited to see. I got to meet him. You know, I've text messaged with him this winter, and I got to meet him for the first time a couple weeks ago down in Tampa when I was there with my coaching staff. Mm-hmm. He's already there working out in great shape. Obviously, people know Gleyber Torres is one of the top prospects in all of baseball, and we're very excited for him, about him. He's going to have a great opportunity in spring to open even more eyes. He's coming off the elbow injury to his non-throwing elbow where he had Tommy John surgery, so he missed the second half of last season, but was on his way to another great season last year. He's fully recovered. He's fully healthy. He's in camp already, just chomping at the bit. And he's a guy I'm really excited to just to see him really embark on what we think has a chance to be a really, really a special career.
Wow. Now, tell me about your family. I mean, your children especially. You have four children. And mm-hmm. how much are they looking forward to see you manage?
I think they are. I think they're all different levels of excitement. You know, my 12-year-old, you know, he's giving me trade advice, and we should sign this guy, where I should hit this guy in the order. So to the other ones, just, you know, kind of just think it's cool and exciting. But, you know, also the fact that we're probably going to have to move cross country, you know, that brings, you know, some things up when you have a 15, a 13, a 12, and an 8-year-old. You know, it's a big change for them coming up as after the school year, they're probably going to move back east. So it's going from Phoenix to the New York area. That's quite a life change.
Yeah, I can imagine. And the final thing, the one thing I want people to know about Aaron Boone, this guy knows his history. I remember when he was with the Nationals, one of the first things we talked about was Greg Luzinski. And I'm just wondering, Aaron, do you still keep in touch with those old Phillies players?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I talked to Ryan Luzinski, who's Greg's son, and I talked to Greg and Gene, throughout the year. And especially, you know, I'm a Philadelphia Eagle fan, so I was back there a few weeks ago with one of my kids, and we went to a game and stuff. So there's those constant conversations with them back and forth about just all that's going on right now with the Eagles. But yeah, I'm in contact with them throughout the season.
Aaron Boone, listen, thank you so much for being on the show. It was greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Bill. Good talking to you.
Likewise. Take care. My next guest is Astros broadcaster Robert Ford, and he had a great time calling the World Series last year. Black history is upon us, and I think it's good to really highlight a person who had a great year in 2017. His name is Robert Ford. He's the radio voice of the Houston Astros, the world champion Houston Astros, and Robert's on the phone now. Robert, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. Always good to talk to you, Bill.
Robert, has it hit you what you've accomplished last year? I mean, you were the voice of the world champion Houston Astros, and you did the last out when they won the World Series.
I don't know that it's fully hit. I think it probably won't until I actually get the World Series ring, because then, you know, every time I see the ring, that'll be a tangible reminder of what happened in 2017. But, I mean, obviously it sunk in more than it did November 1st when it happened. But I still don't know that I fully believe that I experienced what I experienced in 2017.
Now, you made history as well, because we don't see many African Americans in the booth. And the last person that I know of that did the last out of a World Series clincher was Bill White in 1978. And some 40 years later, you're doing it. Tell me how you feel and about making history.
Well, I mean, obviously it's a great accomplishment. I think it is kind of amazing that I'm only one of two who's ever gotten to call that moment. And I think it reflects the fact that I don't think that the broadcasting ranks represent our fan base, represent the diversity that you see on the field, the diversity that you see in our country. And that's something I'd like to see more of. I'd like to see more African-American broadcasters. I'd like to see more Latino broadcasters, more Asian broadcasters, more women broadcasters, because, I mean, these are all groups that are represented on the field. These are people that are represented in the stands, and I think the booth should reflect that. And, you know, I certainly hope that at least in some small way, my presence alone lets people of color know that, you know, there's a place for you in this game, even if it's not on the field, that there can be a place for you in the broadcast booth. There can be a place for you in this game. And I think that's very important for people to feel like they belong in baseball. And that's why I feel like the increased representation is very important.
What has the offseason been like for you? I mean, before you know it, we're coming to spring training now. What has it been like for you?
Well, I'll tell you, it's been a lot shorter. yeah, obviously having the whole month, and certainly not going to complain about that at all. But, I mean, in 2017, if you include spring training and the postseason, January and December were the only 2 months in which the Astros did not play a game. Yeah, you certainly realize that. You certainly feel it a little bit, but it was certainly exciting. But the off season, I mean, I always kind of look at it as a chance to recharge, spend more time with my daughter, and do a little bit of traveling. And I also start to ramp up for the following season, something that I've been going through for the last couple of months or so, just getting ready for 2018. It's been, even though it's been a shorter off season, it's been a good off season. And I mean, I hope that my off seasons continue to be somewhat short.
I hear you. What was your best memory of the 2017 season? It was a great memory.
Well, I mean, obviously winning the championship and being able to call a final out was incredible. Game five of the World Series is a big memory. I mean, that was the best game that I've ever been a part of as a fan or a broadcaster. Just back and forth. Astros down 4-0 with Clayton Kershaw on the mound early, but you know, come back to tie it. Yuli Gurriel had the big game tying 3-run home run. Dodgers go back up by 3. Jose Altuve ties it with another 3-run home run, and then Alex Bregman wins it with the walk-off RBI single in the 11th inning. It was like a boxing match. The two teams were trading blow after blow, and it was just a matter of who was going to be standing when the bell rang at the end. And fortunately, it was the Astros. And but Game Five, I mean, obviously Game Seven, probably my fondest memory of the season, and obviously seeing a team win a world championship. But Game Five, probably the most memorable game of 2017. And like I said, the best game I've ever witnessed in person.
Now, talk about Altuve. I'm sure. Talk about how much you enjoyed watching him play.
It's really been amazing to me just to see how much better he's gotten since I first got to the Astros. You know, my first year with the Astros was 2013, which was Altuve's second full season in the big leagues. And I mean, at the time, you know, he was a good hitter. You know, hit some doubles, a lot of singles, didn't have a whole lot of power. You know, he was a decent second baseman defensively, but he's gotten better in all facets. The defense has gotten better. He's gotten to the point offensively where he can be a run producer and not just be a guy who who looks to just poke the ball to the opposite field. He still has been able to produce power and be a run producer, even while not having his strikeout rate go up a lot. I mean, it's higher than it was back in 2012, 2013, but it's still very low, mm-hmm. especially when you consider what he brings to the table. And beyond that, he's a really special guy, a great guy in the clubhouse, great guy to talk to, always has time for you, is great with his teammates, beloved by his teammates. And, you know, as special as he is on the field, he's very special off the field as well, always generous with his time, with children and charities and things of that nature. And so glad that Jose Altuve is in Houston.
We're talking to Robert Ford, the radio voice of the Houston Astros. Robert, can the Astros repeat? Is this the making of a dynasty?
It's possible. I mean, so many things have to go right for you to win one world championship, let alone two in a row or several over a few years. But, I mean, when you look at this team, they had a great offense last year that was historic with the way that they scored runs and also did not strike out a ton. And those guys are all pretty much back. The pitching staff, I think, will be even better because you'll have a full year of Justin Verlander. And Gerrit Cole coming over from the Pittsburgh Pirates should be a huge addition. And hopefully, I mean, last year the Astros did not have a single pitcher who qualified for the ERA title because all their starting pitchers were hurt at some point. So you're hoping for, you know, a full year of health from Dallas Keuchel, a full year of health from Colin McHugh, who could wind up pitching out of the bullpen to start the season, depending on how things go because of how deep this rotation is. Same thing with Brad Peacock, who was really good and really came into his own last year as a reliever and also did a nice job when he was asked to be in the rotation. You know, you hope Charlie Morton can stay healthy. He had one of his better seasons and one of his healthier seasons in 2017. So, and then the bullpen, you know, you bring back a lot of the key guys. I think bringing in Joe Smith will really help as another guy who can pitch in the back end of the bullpen and really pitch in some important games for the Astros. But, I mean, yeah, and, you know, Hector Rondon coming over, a guy who was non-tendered but had some really good years with the Cubs. You're hoping that he can rekindle what made him so successful when he was closing games for the Cubs. So there are a lot of reasons for optimism, and there are a lot of reasons to believe that this team has a chance to repeat. A lot has to go right, of course, but certainly on paper, the pieces are all in place.
What pride do you take as far as being in that booth and being a member of the Astros?
I take a lot of pride in it. I mean, first of all, I have my dream job. I figured out midway through college that baseball play-by-play was what I really wanted to do, and I wanted to get to the major leagues. And pretty much since my end of my sophomore year in college, I've been trying to figure out how to do that. You know, working in the minors for 7 years, working in Kansas City for 4 years, covering the Royals, doing, you know, pregame shows and postgame call-in shows, and then finally getting this opportunity with the Astros. I love the organization that I work for. I work with great people. I work for great people. I love being in the city of Houston. It's been very welcoming to me and my family. And I like the fact being a guy from New York City and who lived in the north much of his life, like the fact that there isn't a real winter in Houston. That's always a plus. It's a very diverse city. It's a city with a lot going on. So I'm very proud to be in Houston. I hope I'm here for a very long time.
You are from Syracuse. You went to that school. And I'm sure Syracuse must be proud of Robert Ford.
Well, I mean, I certainly hope so. I mean, I kind of get overshadowed, though, by, you know, Bob Costas and Mike Tirico and Sean McDonough and Ted Koppel and some of those guys. But, you know, I mean, I think it's, you know, I'm very proud that I went to Syracuse. Obviously, it's a great university. It's a great school for broadcasting, which is a big reason why I went there. And, yeah, my alma mater has been great to me. Actually, this weekend I'm going to be up in Syracuse, and next week I'm going to be speaking to some communication students, which I've done once before, and that's always a lot of fun for me because I remember being a student and, you know, hearing Bob Costas speak to us and hearing Marv Albert speak to us and hearing Mike Tirico speak to us. And the fact that I'm now at a point and not certainly don't have the career that those guys do, but that I'm at a point where there actually will be students who will show up in a room and actually hear me speak when I remember being one of those students is still pretty remarkable to me.
Robert Ford, listen, thank you so much for being on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Take care. My next guest is former Orioles outfielder Al Bummery. And let me tell you, he's a hero on the field and off. It's Black History Month, and I want to highlight a baseball hero. Not only is he a baseball hero, he is an Army hero as well. His name is Al Bummery. He was a former outfielder with the Baltimore Orioles. Al, thank you so much for being on the show. It seems like you always keep him busy. What is Al Bummery doing these days?
Well, I think I'm busy. I tell myself I'm busy, but I'm not really doing that much. Obviously, I'm retired from baseball. I'm not doing any official baseball stuff within the organization. However, I do play golf. I try to play as much golf as I can. I do, I guess my occupation now is I give private hitting lessons to kids, and I do some baseball clinics in and around Baltimore, and as a baseball camp that I have of my own in the July. And I take care of my yard work around the house, and my mom, who's 98, she lives in Virginia.
Wow.
And you're constantly going down there and, you know, doing stuff down there and take care of her.
Well, that's great.
So it keeps it pretty busy, I guess. From a PR standpoint, I also do some stuff for the Orioles.
Oh, you do? You still keep in touch with a lot of your Orioles teammates?
Well, I guess it all depends on what you mean by a lot. You know, there's five, six, seven, or eight or so that live in Baltimore. So, you know, I see them on a regular basis, and we play golf together. And from a PR standpoint with the Orioles, you know, we see each other, you know, in that capacity also.
Now, you were drafted by the Orioles in 1968, and you started
when it was?
Yeah, they're right. That was 50 years ago. You started with Class A Stockton, and then
Yes. You
didn't stay there long. You didn't hit well, and then you went to the Army for 2 years. Now, did you think you would have the baseball career that you had considering you were in the Army for 2 years?
No, I had, and I think probably the fact that I had to go in the service for 2 years, and I was away from baseball for 2 years, probably is the reason why, you know, I got to play in the big leagues when I did and for the length of time that I did. In fact, people ask me a lot of times, you know, what happened? Because when I went to Stockton, the Orioles wanted to see what I could do prior to going on active duty in June of that year, June of 69. And I went out there because the rookie league season didn't start until June, and the Orioles wanted to see, you know, what I could do. I went out there and I spit the bit. I was terrible. And, of course, when June came around, I was glad to leave, not so much because of the military obligation, but because I had done so poorly, and I was of the opinion that scout didn't know what the hell he's talking about. So when I left, I was glad to leave, but I went into service for 2 years, and I came back from a service and a year and a half I'm playing in the big leagues. So how do you explain that?
Yeah.
And the only explanation I give to people when they ask me that is that maturing factor, and I guess, you know, when, of course, you cannot identify with this unless you've been in a war zone, in a war situation, you know, where every day and every minute, you know, you're concerned and focusing on staying alive. And since I was platoon leader, it was not just my life that I was responsible for. I had 40-some men in my platoon that I was responsible for. And that's a major responsibility. And I think that I matured quite a bit, you know, from that experience. And then when I came back, I guess baseball did not seem to be as paramount as it was before I went over.
Now, how was it tough being in the Vietnam War? I mean, you were there for 2 years.
No. I was only there for a year. But what I did was I went on active duty. I served stateside for the first year, and then the second year I was in Vietnam. So I was only in Vietnam for a year, but I was in the military actively for 2 years.
Wow. Now, when you came back to the States, everything started to click with the Orioles. You were Rookie of the Year, and you helped the Orioles appear in two World Series. You won the World Series in 1983. talk about your career. You've had a pretty good career.
Well, yes, I and I'm very thankful and grateful that, you know, obviously God blessed me to have gotten through the war, number one, and then he's blessed me even more and give me the ability to have a career that I had with the Orioles. So, you know, I've never lost sight of the fact that I know I've been very blessed. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I did have a good career. I, you know, of course, people ask me if I missed the game, and I respond by saying I missed a paycheck. But outside of that, no, I had a very good career. And of course, there were a few ups and downs. But at the same time, you have to roll with the punches. You know, you have those things. But to this day, I honestly believe had I not served in the military, you know, I probably would not have been as successful as I was, you know, for 13 years, you know. If I had to do all over again, I can't say that I would have volunteered to go. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the fact that I missed, you know, 2 years of not playing, but that would not have been a guarantee that I would have gotten to the big leagues, considering how bad I was, you know, when I first started to play in Stockton.
Wow. Your best year was 1980, 205 hits, 118 runs scored, and a .318 batting average. Talk about that year, a great year.
Well, I learned to hit that year. You know, primarily I was a fastball hitter, and majority of the guys that get to the big leagues are fastball hitters. If you can't hit the fastball, you know, you won't be in the big leagues very long. But in that season, I learned to hit the curveball and the sliders, and I saw the ball much better that year. But when I say I learned to hit the curveballs, you know, you cannot imagine, you know, how I looked swinging at curveballs prior to 1980. And here's the story behind that. The year that I broke my leg, I didn't play very much that year. And then I went to South America and Venezuela, and I played down there, and I always hit well down there. And then when I came back in the spring training after I'd broken my leg, I'm sliding to second base, and I jammed my leg again, and they took me out of the game. And this was we were playing in Clearwater. Mm-hmm. So they took me out in the first inning. I couldn't play anymore. And once I went and iced it, and after I iced it, it felt great. And Ralph, my trainer, said that you just broke the adhesions. And I didn't have anything to do for the remainder of that game. So I went down to the clubhouse, and outside the clubhouse there in Clearwater, there was a batting cage that had baseballs in it, and it fed automatically, and it was set on sliders and curveballs. So for the next six innings of the ball game, I was down that cage by myself hitting sliders and curveballs, and my hands were, I mean, if they were white, they would have been black and blue. But I hit off those machines for six innings, and then we go into the season 1980, and I get the 205 hits. And I hit curveballs and sliders and everything, so to speak. So I guess I taught myself how to hit the breaking ball, and that was the primary reason why I had such a good year in 1980.
Final question. Do you like the game today? What do you like about it?
The baseball game, which actually I said earlier that I missed it. I missed the paycheck. I'm not. Sincerely speaking, you know, people ask me that a lot, and that's why I tell them no. I don't miss the game per se. I miss the paycheck, but I don't miss the game per se because, you know, when I retired after the '85 season, I realized that I could not play, or I could not play at the level that was personally satisfying for me. Mm-hmm. So I did not attempt, you know, to get a job after the '85 season because I didn't think I had performed well enough, nor that I feel I could perform well enough to continue playing. So I did not miss the game because I realized it was time for me to ride off into the sunset. But I do miss the camaraderie, you know, that I shared with the guys and being around the guys and the traveling and going to different ballparks. You know, of course, I miss all of that, But I knew it was time, you know, mm-hmm. for me to retire after the '85 season. And I have no regrets about that.
Al Bummery, it was a blast talking to you. Listen, you take care of yourself.
We'll try to do that.
You got it. Take care. My final guest is MLB.com's Richard Justice, who names the 10 players who can determine playoff races in 2018. on the phone is one of the best baseball writers in America. His name is Richard Justice. He's from MLB.com. Richard, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Richard, sad news yesterday. Kevin Towers passed away. He was one of the best GMs around in the 90s, especially. Talk about the job he did.
Probably the greatest tribute to a man is that I would say 200 people in baseball feel they lost a best friend today or one of the closest friends. He was one of those people that everyone liked. He liked people. He liked Colin McCourt. He liked telling stories. Billy Beane told once when they made a trade, Billy, the A's and Diamondbacks made a trade. He goes, well, KT and I know each other so well, it took like 5 minutes to make the trade. Then we spent 30 minutes on the phone telling stories about things, people we'd known and things we'd gone to. That's who he was. And he was a guy that his beliefs, his core beliefs were you needed a certain type of player. And he wanted hard-nosed players. He fired his pitching coach 1 year because they didn't think they had retaliated enough. But, he was a guy, Bill, not unlike you. He liked being at the ballpark. And it's even when he was sick in the last year of his life, he was showing up at the WBC as much as his energy would allow him to. Last time I saw him was after the winter meetings in Nashville in 2015. Mm-hmm. Went to the Grand Ole Opry radio show on Friday night at the Ryman, and Kelly and Kevin were there, and he said something like, "Mel Tillis, if that's the way I'm, if that's considered a good night, it's a good night." But people loved him, and his legacy in the game, probably more than whatever he accomplished in building those Padres teams, is that he was respected and with affection by everyone. He was one of those guys that owned every room he walked into. You wanted to be around the guy.
The amazing part about him, I didn't realize this until yesterday, he won 4 division titles with Bruce Bochy. I didn't realize it was that many.
They were unbelievable. And, you know, his best friend was Barry Axelrod, the great agent. And, mm-hmm. and Ken Rosenthal in The Athletic wrote a great piece about a year ago. They threw a Super Bowl party. Barry, Brian Cashman, people flew in from all over. And Kevin was really sick. And just to have him around his guys. And he would go out early and stay up late. And that was it. And he just, I don't know that what he looked for in players could be weighed or measured. But he could just had that ability to spend his whole life in the game. He could look at a guy and seemed to know whether the guy was the type of guy he wanted on his team once. He traded a guy one time, a good prospect, and we were talking about it. And he goes, yeah, I don't want 4 years from now to still be talking about a guy's potential. And that was it. At mm-hmm. some point you had to see it. But can you imagine Kevin Towers and Bruce Bochy there? I mean, you're not going to get two smarter people there making baseball decisions.
That is true. Now, the reason I called you also was because you wrote a story on the website, 10 players who could determine the playoff races. And this is very interesting names. One guy starts with Garrett Richardson of the Angels. Could you talk about him?
Yeah, and the way I came up with this was like thinking, okay, your managers, your general managers, your players are sitting around going, okay, if we get a monster year out of X, does that put us over the top? It's never that simple. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you can't win without that guy. And Garrett Richards is a guy, he's made 6 starts the last 2 years for the Angels. But he's the definition of a number one. Now, they have other questions, with Tyler Skaggs and Andrew Haney, and can Shohei Ohtani do this thing he's trying to do? But if Garrett Richards is the guy that he has been for most of his career, a number one, then there's 30 starts that you show up. The highest compliment you can give a baseball player is when the players come in and see your name on the lineup card, you think you're going to win that day. And that's going to be a big, big thing for the Angels.
Byron Buxton, this is a guy who got together during the second half. Talk about him.
Yeah, he's only 25 years old, but it seems like he's been around forever because he was the number one prospect for so long. And then just when we were ready to give up on the guy, everything clicked at midseason last year, and he became that guy. And he's a guy that just blows you away when you watch him play, because he's going to win games with at home plate, but he's going to win them on the bases, in the outfield. And what we saw last year emerged down the stretch was the player we thought he was supposed to be, the best prospect in baseball. Braves fans, you want to know what Ronald Acuna is supposed to be? That's who he's supposed to be, Byron Buxton. And that's who he became. He suddenly got comfortable, you know. And so Minnesota went 37-25 after he got after Byron Buxton came back from the minor leagues. And it's like it all clicked. And it's just a reminder that young players don't come with guarantees or timetables. You know, the Twins tried everything. They sent him up. They brought him up. They sent him back down. They batted him up high. They batted him down low. They brought Torii Hunter in to be his mentor, all these things. And sometimes it's if you have the talent, it's going to come through. And but you have to trust that what you see is there, because the results might not be there immediately.
Johnny Cueto, the Giants.
Yeah, he had a bad year last year by his own standards. 4.5 ERA, 1.5 WHIP almost. Started with he was late reporting to spring training because his father was sick and he had to deal with that. And then he got hurt, things that he had never happened before. And here's what's going to happen. Samardzija pitched really well down the stretch. Bumgarner's healthy. So if you have Bumgarner, Samardzija, and Cueto, the Giants, you know, have always been the three championship teams were built around pitching. And that's a place to go. And on opening day last year, that's what we thought. Bumgarner, Samardzija, Cueto. We trust the Giants. You know, we don't know about the other guys, but we trust those. And now with adding Longoria and adding McCutchen and getting, you know, I think they feel like Belt's going to bounce back and Pence is going to bounce back. That's the core of the Giants, and it really comes down to Johnny Cueto being Johnny Cueto. And just, you know, we'll see, but he needs to have a healthy, mind-clearing, productive season.
Jimmy Nelson, this is a guy who's not going to pitch until almost the second half because of a shoulder injury. Talk about him.
Yeah, we don't know about him because he seems to be ahead of schedule, but really you don't know anything till he starts throwing. And he is, the step forward that Zach Davies and Jimmy Nelson took last year were big. And also I should mention Brent Suter, the young kid from Harvard, that they took a big step forward. Now, do the Brewers still need one more guy? Do they still need Arrieta or Yu Darvish or somebody? Yeah, they do. But Jimmy Nelson, to get him back in the second half of the season in a division race where they're now, I think anybody would look at it and say that they're competitive, having added Lorenzo Cain and Christian Yelich. They're a really good team. Jimmy Nelson could be that second half boost that could. I mean, I don't know where they line up with the Cubs and the Cardinals right now, but they got a chance to go to the postseason.
Luke Gregerson with the Cardinals.
You know, the Cardinals have resisted signing Greg Holland. I think some of us thought they were going to sign Wade Davis. They just decided that 3 years, $52 million, I think that's what Wade got from the Rockies, just was not worth it. They have a ton of young pitching. The Cardinals do a ton of young pitching in the minor leagues. They have Alex Reyes coming back from Tommy John surgery, and the best role for him might be as a pitch late in games. And they just weren't going to spend the money. But on opening day, they're going to give the ball. If they have a lead in the ninth inning, they're going to give the ball to Luke Gregerson. And he saved 46 games. He pitched in St. Louis before. He saved 46 games for the Astros in 15 and 16. He knows what he's doing. He's a veteran guy. I think, you know, the Astros went out and acquired Ken Giles last year. And I think, Bill, players like to know their roles. And it's a cliche, your role is to pitch when I tell you to pitch. Well, it's not that simple. And, the best teams, when La Russa would have those teams lined up in St. Louis, the pitchers would know who to get up before the phone even rang. And so they're going to begin with some certainty. Luke Gregerson's going to know that he's going to be the closer in opening day. I think he's got a chance to be really good. And that's maybe the missing link to this team, after having added Marcell Ozuna.
Ian Desmond of the Rockies, he's in the outfield.
Your guy.
Yes.
Yeah, they signed three relievers, so their bullpen is good. They've got all those young starters. You know, some of them are going to stumble, but this is the way they always knew they would have to do it. What you don't understand is how they're going to replace the corner outfielders. You know, they need corner outfielders. Right now, I think Ian Desmond is going to play left field, I think.
Right.
And he was a big signing last year for them. They need him to be healthy and productive. And, you know, you love the guy. I love the guy. He just needs to have a season where he's healthy and can clear his mind and all of that. And they need him because they may go out and get one more bat, and that would make some sense. J.D. Martinez would make a lot of sense, although I don't know that him covering that the biggest outfield in the history of baseball would be good for his legs or anything. But Ian Desmond is a difference maker in terms of that lineup.
Yasmani Tomas with the D-backs.
Yeah, you know, they need to replace J.D. Martinez.
Mm-hmm.
And they need A.J. Pollock and David Peralta to stay healthy. And they have invested in Yasmani Tomas. He's disappointed them at times. He had 31 home runs 2 years ago. So they got to figure out how to replace J.D. Martinez. I'm assuming that he's not going to re-sign there. And Yasmani Tomas is the guy that makes the most sense. The talent's there. He just needs to stay on the field and just be the guy, you know, just – take a deep breath and just play. You're in this lineup with Pollock and Goldschmidt and all these guys. Just have a great year.
Matt Harvey of the Mets.
Most interesting player in baseball, you know, with a nod at tip of the hat to Shohei Ohtani, who's trying to do something nobody's done in 99 years. What can he be? Can he still be Matt Harvey? Will Mickey Callaway, the new manager there, who has such a great reputation dealing with pitchers, will we be able to get through to him? Is it physical? Is it mental now with Matt Harvey? But if he's good, if he can be anything close to what Matt Harvey should be, and all indications are he's had a great offseason, then he lines up with Syndergaard and DeGrom and Mets, and suddenly you take the New York Mets and the NL East look different. Are they going to run down the Washington Nationals? No, but they've got a chance to be. I mean, he might be the guy that elevates them to another place.
Aaron Sanchez, the Brewers.
Yeah, such a talented young guy. He's 25 years old. I like the rotation. You know, they still need some work offensively in the outfield. But he's much like Garrett Richards. He's the number one guy. And when he's healthy and he dealt with blister issues and a sprained finger last year, he just made only 8 starts. He's a guy that when he takes the ball, he beats you. And that's a big deal for a team that's in a dogfight in a division, clearly with the Red Sox and Yankees in front of them. But, you know, if you finish in front of the Orioles and Rays, then you're in the mix for a wild card spot.
The final one is Mookie Betts of the Red Sox.
Seems crazy to be talking about a guy this good having a bounce back year, but he just set the bar so high for him in 2016, 31 homers and an 0.897 OPS. I mean, he's a Gold Glove caliber outfielder. This guy has a chance to be a great player. The numbers were down. The numbers were good last year, but they were down for what the expectations for Mookie Betts are. And they do need another bat. They would like to sign J.D. Martinez. They need more home runs. But just getting Mookie Betts to be Mookie Betts of 2016, that would go a long way toward fixing whatever's wrong in Boston. I'm not sure anything is wrong.
Richard Justice, listen. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
Take care.